Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
I'm gonna come here and like play guitar with Public Enemy and, you know, make hip hop records.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 166, a talk with Scotty Hard. Scott Harding, better known as Scotty Hard, is a producer, engineer, and musician who has been behind the scenes for some of the most notable and boundary-pushing albums in hip-hop and beyond. He's been involved with The Gravediggers, Wu-Tang, The Brand New Heavies, Ultramagnetic MCs, Prince Paul, BDP, Tim Dog, De La Soul, and many, many more than I can fit into this intro. That's not to mention his work with jazz, rock, and unclassifiable acts like Medeski, Martin & Wood, The Crash Test Dummies, John Spencer Blues Explosion, and more. We talk with Scotty Hard at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, make sure to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another unsung engineer and producer, Anton Pachansky, on episode 147. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If a quarter of our listeners contributed even a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus materials that sometimes come out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For September, we're working on putting something great together for you. Become a patron by September 16th at noon Eastern to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's probably the only person to be in a studio with both Wu-Tang and the Crash Test Dummies, Scotty Hard.
So I guess I just wanted to take it back for a second and just ask, what was your musical background growing up in Vancouver?
Well, I played the guitar. I started playing the guitar when I was 11 or something and was in a bunch of bands and whatnot, and mostly sort of underground alternative bands before that term even meant anything, sort of post-punk kind of stuff. And mostly stuff that really didn't belong in Vancouver, so sort of one of the reasons why I moved here. Because everyone's like, oh, Vancouver's beautiful. Why'd you move here? And I'm like, yeah, because I don't really want to make Sarah McLachlan records, you know? Like, and so, and, you know, it's a beautiful place. And certainly the music community and the art community there was a big part of how I sort of developed as an artist. But, you know, it was time to leave. And I moved here in 89 to start doing hip-hop records. So, yeah, I was in a bunch of bands. I studied classical composition and classical guitar and jazz, and played jazz and sort of alt. The bands I was in were more like New York type bands, more like you know,
like No Way.
Yeah, like more like, yeah, James Chance or Pear Ubu or, you know, Talking Heads or something like that, kind of in that vein.
It's better than pleasure.
Than sort of alternative rock kind of stuff. Wasn't really like that. So it was a little bit, we were a little bit odd. And then I also played in kind of a jump swing band that was kind of like sort of a Buster Poindexter kind of thing.
So not entirely serious.
Well, kind of, I mean, serious musically. We were really into, like, we all had old instruments and wore suits and whatnot and was... You know, I'd be like, get a haircut. Dude, you gotta get a haircut. And, you know, we played sort of, it was At one point, it was almost like a Louis Jordan tribute band, and we did all these Louis Jordan tunes from the specific... he made a million records, and he recorded the same tunes many times, sort of like the Thelonious Monk of jazz, you know, but... he made this one record with Mickey Baker playing this sort of proto rockabilly blues type guitar over all the jump swing horns. And that was kind of our template for a long time. But we kind of started out doing weird kind of free jazz, poetry type stuff, and then just sort of evolved into, a almost like the Lounges or just something. And then just started doing these more commercial tunes. And the guy was playing cello, switched to bass, and we just sort of started to do a little bit more of that material, which made it a little bit more straight ahead. But it sort of came from kind of, we were all kind of from the sort of punk scene. So it sort of had a certain kind of edge or irony to it
which isn't, you know, obviously you mentioned Lounge Lizards had that same kind of template.
The Lounge Lizards are a group formed in 1978 by saxophonist John Lurie and his pianist brother Evan. The group drew on rock music and the sound of the then insurgent no wave scene as well as jazz for their distinctive sound. The Lounge Lizards lineup over the years has included such luminaries as Ardo Lindsay, Anton Fear, Mark Ribot, Tony Shear, John Medeski, and many more. In addition to his work with the band, John Lurie is also well known as an actor, composer, and painter. Evan Lurie now composes music for the Nickelodeon show The Backyardigans.
And it's interesting because you move back later on into like the more free jazz kind of experimental.
Sure, I've done a lot of that kind of stuff. Like people wonder where that's coming from, and that's as much a part of my background as any other kind of music, really.
Right. You're playing guitar, you're playing in all these bands. Where did the studio sort of
just
come in?
Just from being in a band. And, I always tell everybody that, there's always one guy in the band that knows what end of the mic cord goes into the mic and what goes. And so that ends up being me. And then, I know a lot of guys like that who just started doing sound or started recording. I was in a band that the singer, she had a studio in her basement, and we had been recording the record on and off over several months or a year, and the producer who was engineering the record said, we need sort of an ambient instrumental for the end of the record. And the girl was like, oh, well, Scott has something, like, and she kind of played him this little cassette demo I had played. He's like, perfect, that's great. So I call him up and say, okay, well, when are we going to record this thing? He goes, I'm not recording it. You can record it. I don't have time. I'm too busy. So I was like, oh, okay. Because that's sort of like my whole MO. It's like, sure, okay, let's do it. And, I'd be running, I'd put the tape machine in, record it, 20 seconds before the song started, run out into the live room and playing handbells and percussion and all that kind of stuff. And so it just sort of started from there, and the keyboard player in that band was doing a lot of dance scores and stuff, so I was recording and producing all his stuff, and just sort of started kind of recording, during the time of being in a band and whatnot. And, it just seemed like it was time to leave. I was getting more serious about doing that, and I just felt like, well, everybody knows me as a guitar player in these bands, there's 3 or 4 guys that get all the work recording and producing all the sort of underground music. So I'm like, well, and that's sort of the Canadian ethos. It's like, who'd we use last time? They were fine. Whereas you come to New York and they're like, where's that new guy?
Right.
He'll probably be cheap. people sort of kid around with the sort of phrase that America is the land of opportunity, but it really is, Certainly was for me.
Yeah. So you came here in 89. Was the idea, I'm going to come here and work in studios, or I'm going to
come here and play guitar with Public Enemy and, make hip hop records.
Mm-hmm. You didn't manage to kick Vernon Reid out of a job though.
No. Yeah. I ended up doing New Kingdom.
New Kingdom was Hart's group with the rappers Nassage and Sebastian. The group released two albums.
And that was kind of, to me, you know, ultimately more interesting than just joining someone else's band.
Right. Oh, right. I forgot you actually recorded his album, which we've talked about.
Oh, Vernon's?
About. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I worked with Vernon, yeah, for many times, many years.
Yeah. So you got here, you were at Chungking first?
Chungking House of Metal, now known as Chungking Recording Studios, is a New York City studio that, in its original Chinatown location, was where many early classic hip-hop albums were recorded. Artists included Run-DMC, LL Cool J, Public Enemy, Stetsasonic, Third Bass, Slick Rick, The Beastie Boys, and more.
How did that happen?
You've done a little research, huh?
Yeah.
My friend Bob Coulter, who is a Vancouver guy, who was also kind of from the same music scene, he was working here, and then another guy that he was friends with, this guy Bill Hemme, he had drafted Bill to come out from Vancouver and move to New York, and he was working at Calliope Studios, and they needed more engineers. And Bill moved back. He just, you know, I guess didn't want to live in New York for the rest of his life. And I was started thinking about doing that, and I had been working with him on a couple of projects. And he's like, yeah, you'd be great. You should just go there. And so I called the guy up from Calliope, and they say, well, sure. I mean, can't guarantee anything. So, you know, I came here, and, you know, Bob was working at a bunch of different... He had been kind of a house guy at Calliope, and he was the guy that recorded most of Stetsasonic's stuff, and he was doing a lot of sort of... he and Daddy-O were doing a lot of production remixes and stuff and sort of floating around town at all these different studios, and they were working at Chungking a lot.
Right. That was the period that Daddy-O was sort of starting to do a lot of production stuff. Yeah, because we had Lisa Cortez on the show. I think she was managing him at that point as a producer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just mentioned her name to somebody the other day. We're talking about Mercury Records and all that stuff that was going down.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I, you know, would just pop in on all his sessions and just, you know, sit in the corner and say nothing and, like, watch how things were going down. And they needed somebody to work at Chungking. And so I kind of bluffed my way into that job. And that, you know, the rest is history. And then, you know, then the guy found out I was Canadian and decided that was a good reason for him to, like, not pay me all the money he owed me. And,
because of the exchange rate? Like, what
no, because I was illegal. So I wasn't working legally. So he was like, oh, well, you know, I just found out you're Canadian. Well, you're fired. And, you know, I'm like, hey, you owe me $400 or something. And he's like, well, too bad. Whatever. Anyway. And so then that's when I kind of, then that was maybe for 6 months. And that's when I went to start to work at Calliope more full time. But yeah, Chungking, I was like, the first few records I did that I worked on were there. And the first session I ever did was with Tone Loke. it was in the 900 number days.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes in like a full, this is January. You know, I moved here like January 6th or something. And, you know, came from, everyone thinks, oh, you come from Canada. You're used to the cold. But Vancouver, it just rains all the time. I mean, you know, it's freezing cold here in the winter. I never even owned a down jacket when I lived in Canada. So he walks in a full length mink coat, and it's for an ad for the Tone Phone, 1-900 Tone Phone.
Yo, this is MC Tone Loke, and now you can reach me live and direct on my brand new Funky Cold Medina hotline. It's easy, just pick up your phone and call. And if you're one of my lucky randomly selected callers, you get to talk to me, Tone Loke. So hurry up.
And this guy from MTV was the producer, and he just had the vinyl of Wild Thing, right? And so he had a vinyl of that, and you know, Chungking was a hip hop studio, so of course there was a turntable. So he's like, okay, well, we'll just record the first part, and then he can talk over it. But you know, we need you to edit out those first 8 bars so that it just comes right in on the guitar riff. No problem. I do that all the time. Just like, you know, why don't you guys go get a cup of coffee? And so we record the thing down, and then I'm like, fuck, I've never done this before. And I, you know, I sort of edited on like a quarter inch machine before, but never on a big 24 track. But as I said, you know, my MO was just fake it.
Right.
And, you know, I make the marks, do it, get the razor blade out, and cut the thing, put it back together, and push play. And boom, 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 bam. I'm like, whew, cut the jump. And then, you know, years later, I realized, like, oh, man, I made the edit on the wrong head. But I made both edits on the wrong head, so it ended up... It ended up working, but...
Amazing.
That was sort of the beginning of my bluffing my way through the recording studio world of New York City. But that was pretty funny.
What was the environment at Chungking like? I feel like people sort of have this vision of it as like this crazy place that used to be a Chinese restaurant, and it was always, you know, the Beastie Boys.
Don't think it was ever a Chinese restaurant.
Is that where the name? No?
Yeah, it was in Chinatown, wasn't a Chinese restaurant.
Scotty is right, of course. Chungking got its name not from a nearby restaurant. Instead, it was named by Rick Rubin as a combination of its Chinatown location and owner John King's name. However, the studio's original sign did say Chungking Chinese Meals and Takeout.
It was on like the 8th floor of a building in the middle of the street on Center Street. And they had one room downstairs that was like an automated fancy Neve room. And then upstairs, they had a little room with sort of a long live room and a little sort of small control room with what I think is almost the exact same console that I now have. It's like a small Neve broadcast console. And it was very simple setup and not fancy or anything. And that's where, you know, they did a lot of tracking and stuff. I don't think they mixed up there that much. So I just had the two rooms at that point. And that was a long time ago, because now, I mean, it was been 20 years since they moved to, I think they've been on Varick Street. I've never even been to that place, but I think they've got a couple of SSLs there. It's a whole different kind of setup. But, you know, I mean, Chungking was... You know, like Heather, she became Lady of Rage. I rock rough and stuff with my Afro puffs. Rock on with your male self. I rock rough and stuff with my
Afro puffs. Rock on with your male self. I rock with my... Robin Yvette Allen, better known to rap fans as the Lady of Rage, had a production deal with the LA Posse early in her career and worked out of Chungking.
She was like an intern there, and she like answered the phones, and one of the guys from the Leaders of the New School was hanging out there. I think he was an intern, and those guys were like always around. I kind of vaguely knew them, but not really. Steve Ett, who was the guy who did all the LL stuff, he had kind of phased himself out of there, but was, you know, I saw him around there a couple of times.
Steve Ett is an engineer who, after beginning his career recording singer-songwriters like Ricky Lee Jones and Janis Ian, became Rick Rubin's go-to engineer in the early years of Def Jam. He did early albums with LL Cool J, The Beastie Boys, Run DMC, and more.
So, you know, it was early days of hip-hop kind of... things were a lot different then, you know? It was... People didn't just walk into the studio with their beats.
Right.
You know, they just walk in with a record. And then, you know,
and it was the engineer's job to put it together and loop it and so forth.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, for me, that was no problem because I was a musician, you know. So, you know, and I guess that's why the Calliope guys were looking for guys that Bob knew, like guys who weren't just engineer guys who knew how to solder a cable or understood what ohmage was or whatever. They were guys who had some musical skill. I mean, I still describe myself as a musician as opposed to an engineer or something, because I really have no background in that.
Right. That's interesting. I feel like that sort of comes up a lot when people look at the late 80s and early 90s in hip-hop in terms of, like, what does production mean and all, you know, production credits and stuff like that. And it's like, well, is it the person who had the idea to loop the record? Is it the person who actually, like... made the loop happen? Is the person who thought of the stuff to put on top of the loop?
Sure,
like, there's, you know, no there, hard,
there's,
fast all, answers,
there's lots of levels on that, you know, because nowadays most people, and you know, even now, I mean, people call themselves record producers, but really they make beats. Mm-hmm. But if you're a guy who makes beats, but you understand how to conceptually make a record and put things together and listen to everything, and you know, like a guy like Prince Paul, for instance, from back then. You know, they was a real producer. A lot of these guys weren't producers. They just made beats and would, you know, sit in the back and get high or leave, you know. So the engineer did a lot of stuff, but at the, you know, or just the members of the band were just kind of, you know, taking charge of, okay, let's do the hook now, let's overdub this, whatever. So it was a little bit more fluid than just there being like sort of one producer who is there kind of knowing everything, like, seeing the big picture, because that's ultimately what a producer has to do, you know, because some producers are like a guy like Quincy Jones, who's an arranger and a musician and a guy writing and stuff. And then some guys are much more technical, and some guys really are just vibe guys. And, you know, I mean, that's legitimate too. You know, I mean, as somebody who knows what sounds good and what's working, you know, whether you can play fucking Giant Steps or whatever, it's not a pissing contest, which it so often is in the music game. But so there's a lot of different approaches to production.
Sure. And how did you first meet Prince Paul? I saw that you engineered a ton of his recordings over like Calliope, a long period of time.
At Calliope.
Was that on the second De La record?
It was around that time. And I worked on that a little bit, but very little. But I guess, yeah, that's where I actually first met him. Because back then, Calliope was just, there was, I don't know, five or six guys who were the house guys. And around the time I started working there was when they built the second room. And they eventually had three rooms at one point. So they needed a bunch, and it was going 24 hours a day. So you'd come in and you'd be the new guy. So you'd be pulling the fucking midnight shift, and you'd like, guys would come in and you'd take out the book and you'd be like, okay, 7 hours, $35 an hour, 8.25% sales tax. You owe us whatever, $643.19. And, you know, you'd have to take the money from these guys before you even started a session. So it's, you know, it's not the greatest way to kind of kick off an artistic relationship, which it really never really was in those kind of night things. So anyway, you just sweat your way through all those and do a bunch of things. And then for the bigger things, like, you know, whoever was in there, De La or that or Brand Nubian or whoever, you know, they would often have the same guy and people would request the same guy, but, oh, that guy's sick, can you do the session? I mean, it was just, I mean, and literally, you know, the sessions would go, because, you know, they weren't big setups with drums and stuff, you know, you could have the De La session ends at 5 o'clock and Black Sheep are starting at 5 and their session would be booked for 5 o'clock. Like, it was literally back to back shit. There was not even they wouldn't even account for turnover or whatever. You'd be late and these guys would be waiting in the hall, and sometimes they'd be upset and you'd get people having a little beef here and there. But so I just ended up going in and doing some stuff with Paul, and he guess he liked me, and he was starting this thing called Resident Alien,
right?
And he said, oh, get that new guy to come and work with me. So I'm like, okay. And I think actually the first session I did with Resident Alien, somebody was late and we were like waiting in the hall. So, and I can't remember if Paul was even there, and I barely knew him, but you know, a couple of the guys were there from the band, and this one guy, Dragon, who was like the kind of comedian guy, was like, yeah, you play the bass? I'm like, yeah, I can play the bass. All right, we might need someone to play the bass. I'm like, okay, cool. So eventually, you know, we get in the studio and we start setting up, and you know, and then he's like, comes over to me and goes, man, you should be practicing the bass, man. What the fuck? I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, right. But it was, you know, that was just like the usual kind of like just breaking on you, snapping, that sort of whole culture that I had to like kind of get used to. It's not, people don't do that in Canada.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah. And so, you know, once you started working with Paul, you know, obviously you worked on a whole bunch of projects together, you know, Gravediggers and Handsome Boy through like Chris Rock and all that kind of stuff. What was your working relationship like once you got to know each other a little bit?
You know, just see who comes with the best jokes and whatnot. You know, he trusted me to do my job, and, you know, I would help facilitate a lot of stuff. Like in the earlier days, sort of post Calliope, you know, we'd be like, oh, where should we do this? I mean, he just like put everything on me. Okay, can you book the studio? We got to do this Cypress Hill remix. We got to do this. We got to do that. Like, okay, you know, and I'd call the studio. So I would do some of that sort of work of the producer or the executive producer, you know, do that, order the reels, the tape, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we actually collaborated on a couple of things. At one point, that girl Vinia Mojica was doing a record, and Paul and I were kind of co-producing some stuff for her that never came out. And, you know, he would usually hire me when somebody else was paying for it, basically, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, a mixed stuff. And at one point, he was producing something for this guy, Jay Live.
As I start from scratch about this born suspect named me, a street legend. Pulling hits was his infatuation. From birth, his first spoken word was tech. So by the age of 12, you could guess what would dominate his conversation. He had a twin brother.
And I went in and mixed it for him because he was out of town. And Paul was like, well, the only guy I trust to do this is Scott. So you know, whatever, J-Live called me up and was like, okay, meet you at the studio. And I remember years later, I'm like, hey, man, how you doing? He goes, over Wax Paper, right? So that was the name of the song that we did. He's like, Wax Paper. And I'm like, yep, Wax Paper.
Nice. And so you did, I was curious about this because you did, you worked on both Gravediggers albums.
Yep.
And, you know, Paul was obviously heavily involved in the first one.
Yep.
And
not so much in the second.
Not so much in the second. And by the second, RZA was a star, whereas the first one came out post-Wu-Tang, but was recorded pre-Wu-Tang.
Yeah. Basically, it was his vision.
Yeah.
So he put those guys together, the sort of Tommy Boy rejects.
Right.
As they sort of refer to themselves as from time to time.
Yeah. I got one last question. Who killed Tommy's boy?
All of the members of the Gravediggers had prior experience with Tommy Boy Records. Prince Paul had, of course, produced the first three De La Soul albums for the label and was also a part of Stetsasonic, who were also on Tommy Boy. Poetic got dropped by the label after releasing one single in 1989. RZA, under the name Prince Rakim, had a single deal with the label who forced him to make unrepresentative, very commercial music on his 1991 EP, Ooh, I Love You, Rakim. Rukwan was also a member of Stetsasonic, but left the group after their second album.
Yeah, well, RZA, you know, wielded a lot of power at that point, you know, at that time, you know, he was doing so many things and he was really on a roll. And the record company, you know, were obviously enamored of him and wanting to sort of get in on some of that Wu-Tang action, kind of. So RZA kind of did that whole second record.
Yo, the pre-existence of the mathematical biochemical equations, the manifestation of rock, plant, air, fire, and water, which are in its basic formation. Solid, liquid, and gases that cause the land masses and the space catalysts and all matter that exists in its dense third dimension. There must be observed the physical comprehension. It takes a nerve to be struck. Wisdom is the wise word spoken to wake up the dumb who've been sleeping. The fourth dimension is time.
Carlos Best and I flew out to L.A. and he rented a Ray Parker Jr.'s studio called American, spelled, you know, M-A-M-E-R-A-Y-C-A-N, American. And he had kind of like two identical rooms and like a big lobby in between in the valley somewhere. And he was like 6 months late finishing the Wu-Tang record.
Sure.
And so, but then he kind of spun the Gravedigger thing into that, like, you know, because he was going to be out there trying to, he thought was, let me get these guys out of New York and we'll actually get some shit done. I think, yeah, he thought, well, let me get those guys out of New York, which, you know, because, you know, you do sessions with them back then in New York and they'd come like 10, 12 hours late, these guys, and roll in with 19 guys and shit. It was just chaos. So I think RZA thought, let me take all these guys out there. And, oh, by the way, I got to do the Gravedigger record too. So let me do that. So he called me and said, you know, I want you to come out and do this with me. Like, okay. So, and it was funny because like the first week, I hadn't recorded any of the Gravedigger record. I think Carlos had recorded most of it. And Carlos was RZA's engineer for the first, like, Enter the 36 Chambers and a bunch of stuff around that time. So we go and I go in and meet Carlos. We're like instantly we're roommates, you know, at the Oakwoods, like live-in celebrity apartments in Toluca Hills. They're like, oh, you know, these guys, they're the engineers. Well, like they'll obviously get along because they're both nerds or whatever. Put them in the place. So we had, you know, this two-bedroom apartment and, you know, sort of got to know each other. And neither of us could drive, which was typical New Yorker thing. So we were just taking cabs there every day. And then, you know, the first week, you know, I go, and I know the guys, like Poetic and Fruquan were there. Paul was not there when I got there. So, you know, I'm like, okay, what song do you guys want to work on today? And so I mixed for a week, you know, I mixed, I don't know, five songs or something. Yeah. But Carlos was like, oh, yeah, I really like this one song. Can I mix that one? I'm like, yeah, sure, man. Like, and he was like, so, you know, I was mixing and just sort of, you know, business as usual kind of thing for the week. And, you know, we'd take breaks and I'd walk across and he'd be just sitting there with the same song on for 5 days. he had Triumph up on the fucking thing and just waiting for all the guys from the band to come in and do their verses, because that was going to be the first single, and that's what they had to get that done.
Right.
And so you just hear that booming out of that room like for 5 days straight.
I bomb atomically. Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't define how I be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically perform armed robbery. Flee with the lottery. Possibly they spotted me. Battle scars.
And I don't think he even ended up mixing it that first week. So, you know, and so, you know, and we had like Sundays off. So we had days off and we're, you know, in the car on the way home or on their day off. I'm like, hey, man, you want to work with the Gravediggers this week and actually do something? I'll like go in and babysit with the Wu-Tang, you know, and whatever happens. He's like, yeah, that'd be great. And then I can mix those songs I want to do. I'm like, okay, cool. So Monday, you know, and you show up. We, you know, we would show up at 2 o'clock and like the first guy possibly might have walked in at 5.
Right.
You know, from Wu-Tang. And they, you know, they sort of dribble in and like, yo, where's Carlos? I'm like, oh, he's in the other room working with the Gravediggers. I got the song up. You know, let me know if you guys want to do something else. And they would just leave. And every, you know, one by one, people come, where the fuck is Carlos? He's in there. You know, and they would leave. And then, you know, finally RZA comes in and it's like, what the fuck are you doing in here? I'm like, well, and Carlos wanted to mix a couple of Gravedigger songs. I just figured we'd switch up because he'd never said, you guys, you have to do this and you have to do that.
Right. It was just what you were used to, whatever.
We're going against his authority a little bit. And he goes, I never told you to do that. I'm like, yeah, I guess, no, you didn't. But, you know, if, I figured, you know, it's going to kind of be spread out between us anyway. So, and he's just sort of looking at me like probably incredulous, like, how dare he? Like, disobey my orders. Well, there was no real orders. It was, and you know, eventually it was like, okay, whatever.
Right.
You know, they didn't care. And then eventually, you know, the Gravedigger record got, then Paul came out the week after. And, you know, that record eventually got done in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, probably 2 weeks. And those guys went home, and then both rooms were just
Wu-Tang forever.
Wu-Tang forever, all day, every day. And it was funny because they were like, and I never made the deal, but I was happy that the owner, the manager of the studio was like, well, you know, I got to give the everybody a day off. We're not going to work on Sundays. And RZA's like, we want to come in tomorrow and work on Sunday. And what the assistants were like, well, no, well, we can't do that because it's why not? Because, well, we, you know, we need to have a day off and this and that. And RZA's like, well, you guys don't do anything. Scott and Carlos are doing everything. You guys don't even need to be here. And they're like, well, it doesn't really work like that. And whatever. Anyway, it was pretty funny. And the other thing that was fucked up about that job is because I think the ODB record had been leaked like 6 months before that. Like nothing was left at the studio. So we were taking home like 25 reels of 2-inch tape, and, you know, sticking them in the trunk of a cab and driving them back to our hotel and unloading them and stuff. And like one time, one of the guys, because they all had Jeeps or like half of them had cars. So one time somebody, I can't remember, you got or someone had a car. It's like, oh, I'll take the reels. I'm like, oh, okay, great. But then, of course, we show up the next day and like, where are all the reels? I'm like, well, they're in the back of Yui's truck, you know, wherever he is. Yeah. That's where they are. So that was, you know.
It's just missing for the
first
time.
Pretty funny, like
the day.
Having all these 2-inch reels of this record, like in with the spare tire in some guy's cab in Los Angeles.
Amazing. Another potential, I don't know if it was difficult, but seems like it might have been difficult record you worked on was the Brand New Heavies, if only because there was a different guest vocalist on every track.
Oh, that
the
was
heavy
easy.
Rhyme experience. That was easy.
Yeah, because those guys just brought the tapes in. They recorded them in London. And
oh, so you already had the instrumental tracks by the time you were recording
like
the vocal.
Half the, like, I think, you know, the 2 or 3 or 4 of the guys in the band were there. Yeah, you know, cool guys with flares on, you know. And you know, it was just all guys that we knew, you know, that like Black Sheep.
I'm in a state of yap, so if I go to the split that I pass, mix it back with the slack from my man with the tan sitting by the fan. In a heavy, heavy band.
Guys that I'd been working with and stuff. So that was easy. I mean, it's funny because to me, like, that's just the most non thing I ever did. And, you know, people don't always bring it up, but it was a blip on the radar, that's for sure. But yeah, it was just sort of like the day at the office at Calliope. It's like, oh, these guys from England are here and they're recording these guys. Oh, okay, cool, whatever, you know, put the reels up. And the guys had chosen songs. And I recorded Drez. I might have recorded Pooba.
Goodness grief, let me lighten up the brief. Honey, spell grand Pooba when they want to spell relief. Who is the man more than 100 grand? Give a pound to
a friend, put a tool to a clan. Damn.
Yeah, I think I recorded that Jamalski. Anytime I come and I say around the party, I make them on the mic with the brand new weapons. Who is a dog like Mr. Malski? I made them an animal, made them an atom, made them a shimmy. Jump and move and jump and move and jump and. I can't remember who else is on that record, but, you know.
It's a lot of people on that record.
Yeah, but there was a bunch of West Coast guys and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, G-Rap's on it also.
Yeah, I wanted to. I was like, you guys should get me to mix this, you know, like get a hip-hop guy to mix this. But, you know, they didn't. I don't think that record sounds particularly good, but, you know.
Yeah.
I only listened to it once.
Speaking of England, you work with the Stereo MCs.
Yep.
I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they were the first British rap group to have any traction at all in the U.S.
Probably.
But yeah, I think so.
I mean, unless, you know, you count Moni Love.
But they were closer to, like, kind of the dance rave thing that was going on in the U.K.
Not the record I worked on.
No?
Not really. It was pretty straight-up hip-hop stuff. And they kind of, their second record kind of pushed them in that direction of more of an electro kind of thing. They knew Africa because Jungle Brothers had been on G Street Records in England, and they had put out a few.
So they knew Baby Bam.
Yeah, and they said, we want to come to New York and do some work with you and mix our record there. And he says, okay, well, you should go to Calliope Studios and work with this guy, Scott. And because at that point, I had been working with Africa a lot. We did a bunch of remix stuff. Yeah, I'd done this Ladysmith Black Mambazo thing with him. We had been doing a bunch of stuff, and we were getting along well. And so that's how that kind of happened, and that's sort of how my relationship with G Street Records sort of began. And I ended up doing a bunch of records for them, and New Kingdom got signed to them, and Gravediggers got signed to them.
But, and, you know, you've mentioned, you know, Drez and the Black Sheep guys a couple times. What do you remember about making a wolf in sheep's clothing?
Well, about a half or a third of that record I recorded, and they were just demos for them to get their deal. Funk and Klein, Red Alert Productions was managing them or whatever, and Funk and Klein.
Dave Funk and Klein worked at Def Jam and Red Alert Productions, wrote for The Source, and also ran the label Hollywood Basic, home of Organized Confusion. He passed away in 1995 after a long battle with cancer.
You know, he came into Calliope, which is what everybody just went to Calliope, and recorded them and a bunch of those tracks. And then once they got their deal, I didn't really work on that record very much. But I do remember recording the vocals for The Choice Is Yours for the remix, because he redid the vocals.
Black sheep, what's a black sheep? No, not who I am or when I'm coming, so you sleep. Wasn't in my room or wasn't in your sphere. Knew not who I was, but listen here. Who's a black sheep? What's a black sheep? No, not who I am or when I'm coming, so you sleep. Wasn't in my room or wasn't in your sphere. Knew not who I was, but listen here.
Up until that time, he always had that real smooth delivery. Like, he never did that sort of amped up kind of thing that he did on Who's a Black Sheep? What's... Because I was looking at Long, and I was just sort of like, is he all right? Like, he goes, turn his voice way down in the headphones and turn the music up. I want him to yell. I'm like, oh, okay. So it was like, that was a real change in his delivery at that and doing that. And right. It was funny because he came up and did that song live with Handsome Boy Modeling School, like, I don't know, 10 years ago. And I was the guest bartender. Because they'd set up a bar at the back of the stage, and they have a guest bartender every night on their tour. So they asked me to be the guest bartender. So, of course, I'm like, who else?
Right.
Of course. And so he goes up to do that song. And I think Paul came back and was standing with me. And I was like, I recorded this song.
Yeah. Do you remember why they decided to do a remix of that? Did you have any idea?
Well, when you get Dave Gossett in here, you can ask him.
Well, let me explain. I'm the A&R man, Dave Gossett. Yes, I rock it. I ripped the mic.
Dave Gossett, along with Cypher episode 92 guest Lisa Cortez, was an executive producer on Black Sheep's 1991 album, A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, as well as the Ultramagnetic MC's 1992 album, Funk Your Head Up.
Or maybe Lisa would have known. Well,
yeah,
Did remixes of everything. I mean, that was, everything was remixed and done again. And I mean, Papa Large off the Ultra record I did, no one ever really ever knew about that original version. They just, you know, and he even did the vocals again.
Dipping the mic, I plug it up in your ears, crazy and rude. I'm coming out like bears, like Rango, Miller Quartz and Buds. I'ma eat them with popcorn and treat them like sub. Ripping the mic, I plug it up in your ears, crazy and rude. I'm coming out like bears, like Rango, Miller Quartz and Buds. I'ma eat them with popcorn and treat them like sub, shit duds.
So people would just do from time, you know, wouldn't, if it was someone in the band or someone close to the band, like people would do the vocals again because they might want to change the tempo of the track or something. And rather than just working with locking the existing vocals up on tape and putting a new beat under it,
yeah,
they would just, you know, sort of start from scratch, which was cool.
How was working on Funk Your Head Up, by the way? Any crazy cool Keith
escapades? There's always a million stories with that. Tim Dog was kind of blowing up at that time, and so we were working on his record around the same time.
Oh wow. Yeah, because I knew you did stuff with Penicillin and Wax too.
And I want the next man to get up on the mic and speak what the fuck he feels like.
Rap, it's a trade that won't quit. Every motherfucker wanna make a hit. Using big words, using small words, using no words, but that's absurd. But metaphor has yet to...
Those were more or less simultaneous?
Kind of around the same time, yeah.
Wow.
And the Lifers Group record was kind of in there as well.
Click, click is what I heard, and then the shit got thick. To my surprise, I opened my eyes to find a bump in my dick. And the other at my head while I lie in my bed. Huh? I thought to myself that any second I'd be dead at 21.
So sort of like Funk and Klein, Tim Dog, Ultra. I mean, I think that I might have initially met those guys because Funk and Klein brought them in to do the Tim Dog demos, and then... I got along well with Trevor and Sed, and so I just ended up doing that. We recorded a lot of that at Calliope, and then we mixed it at this other place. 39th Street Music was the first time I ever used an SSL.
An SSL is a brand of mixing console.
Because I was like, man, maybe I should like get an internship at a studio where they have an SSL and learn how to use an SSL. And then it's like, hey, we got this job at this place with an SSL. I'm like, perfect. That goes
right.
That goes better. That's more like my narrative, you know?
Yeah.
That's how that happened. And yeah, there was some funny stuff always. I mean, those guys are funny, and there's, you know, countless incidents and stuff that would be. It was funny because they would be like, you know, that was the big thing. It's like, do we have a PO? It's like, oh, yeah, there's a PO, which meant they have like that they could order lunch and the studio would pay for it and just
right.
Tack it onto the bill of the session. Or, you know, Scotty, we got a PO. Yeah. Okay. So they order food from like this place called Jackson Hole or something like that, which is like, and you know, like, yeah, let me get two cheeseburgers and fries and a shake and this and that. And you know, it was just, you'd lose your food so easily. So, you know, everyone would have like, there'd be a million cheeseburgers and stuff. I'm like, who had a quiche? I'm like, that's me. Because you always get your fucking dinner if you ordered. I think I was a vegetarian at the time anyway. But, like, you know, you order something completely out of the stratosphere of the hip-hop world. Like, oh, yeah, tuna melt me. You know, so, you know, I always get my food if. But, yeah, like, see this big box would come in, 36 cheeseburgers in it. Pretty funny.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, Tim Dog was just such a wild character.
Oh, yeah. And he passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and people didn't believe it at first. They thought he faked his own death because he was so
desperate
outrageous.
For publicity.
Yeah.
In February 2013, there were reports of Tim Dog's death due to complications from diabetes. By the following May, several stories surfaced investigating whether Tim Dog had faked his own death in order to avoid charges of grand larceny stemming from the rapper conning a woman out of tens of thousands of dollars in an online dating scam. In September 2014, a death certificate surfaced, and Tim Dog was finally confirmed dead.
I think he was living in England at the time. He was a funny guy. He was a funny guy. I think on Penicillin on Wax, it was like, okay, we're going to do the skit. Okay, we need a cop. Scotty, get up here. I'm like, you know, because that's always the only white guy.
Right.
It's
one night when the 5-0 rolled up, pulled me over,
said enough. Let me see your driver's license and your registration right now, boy.
Oh, why got me all that? What did I do? I ain't do nothing, man. Why are you fucking with me?
Don't give me any of that smart talk, nigga. I'll haul your ass down to jail right now.
Alright. I got something. Smoked his ass.
So it's like, of course I'm the cop. Alright, so I'm the cop. Yeah, he actually wanted to start a band. He's like, yo, let's start a band. And like, oh, with this guy, no, like just a bunch of guys like you with glasses and we wear hoodies. And, you know, he wanted to, it was like when Ice-T had his like body count, he kind of wanted to do that. Kind of like a heavy rock, rap rock thing. He wanted me to be his band leader. That never worked out.
Oh, man. And, you know, so one of the more recent hip hop records you've done, you did a bunch of stuff with Ka and John DJ Preservation.
Yep.
That stuff.
Best MC out there, man.
Yeah. Well, that's
one of the best MCs of all time, if you ask me. Like, Dante Ross and I had an argument about that recently, but I'm like, well, let's just agree to disagree on that one. Ka is amazing. Amazing vocalist. His lyrics are off the chart, and he's one of the greatest guys I know. A nice guy. Really deep.
Yeah, and those records, especially, I mean, the Yen Lo and all that stuff has such a consistent aesthetic in the way his voice is, in the way the music is, and the, you know, the song titles and the skits.
All get a life, not all gonna live. Some soar to the heights, some fall on shiv. Some are bored by vice, get torn by sex. Some war for rice, others spoiled as kids.
The overall sound, like, what's your role in that?
I did it all.
That was you?
It's all me. 100%. Fuck you, Jean. No, I mean, that's a pretty conceptual record. And Jean, I had been working with him. I met him through Mike Ladd. And we started doing some stuff together before my accident. So maybe like 10 years ago, 10, 11 years ago. I mixed some stuff for Mos Def on one of his records. And couple other things. Jean had like a solo record, and he had a couple of tracks on this. I can't remember the name of the record, but it's sort of like, it was a white cover, and it like had sort of the Apple sign on it. So I think Apple had something to do with it, but it was kind of like a various artists kind of thing. And so, and we used to see each other around, but that's how I met Ian, actually. It was okay. Through Jean, and we just became friends and started working together. And he said, I've got this thing and wanted me to come and work on it. And, you know, I he's like, oh, check this guy out, he's really good. And I checked out a couple of his videos, just these black and white videos. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. You know, I really, you know, made me excited about, you know, hip-hop for sure, because he's really extremely talented guy. And and you know, the production is really very, you know, I said to my assistant, I'm like, yeah, this working on this record, it's like an exercise in you know, subtlety. Because it's just, there's no boom bap drums or anything. It's really atmospheric, and just, you know, there'd just be a couple of elements that would sort of change slightly. And then Jean would just have like the tiny, like one timpani hit or two bass notes in the bridge or something. It was just all very focused.
Stand on that land where man is hated, outside where the scramblers waited and waited.
So, you know, he really had to kind of integrate any other instrumental stuff into that texture that they had already built. And then his voice, the way he layers his voice and the way he does his vocals, it's almost like a choir. Like, you know, it's almost like he's harmonizing with himself.
I switched off the shit's off. The groovy don't move me. Got the kids lost, crazy rule. Days removed from baby fool. A young divine, I'm a fine, blind ways is cruel. Listen, what you pitching, son? Got him sick and dumb. See soul of jewels.
And, you know, you made a hip-hop record or hip-hop-influenced record of your own back in 99, The Return of Kill Dog E.
Yeah.
Sensational with the broadcast. If you wouldn't have been on this track, you would have had this type of cash. It's an earring, 10 fingers, 10 diamond rings, common sense. I'm about cash, suspended, the baller. I slide through borders with mothers and daughters. I'm free.
Say it's sort of hip-hop.
Sort of hip-hop record. What inspired you to make that album?
Well, Skiz Fernando, the guy who ran Word Sound, just, I had been doing, contributing tracks to all his compilation records.
Yeah.
And to like Bill Laswell's and different things. And so he said, oh, you should do a whole record. And I'm like, okay. And my friend Omar Sanchez, who had done like the graphics for New Kingdom, and he would go on the road with us, and we were roommates on tour a lot of the time, and just good friends. And he kind of came up with this character called Kill Dog E because we were sitting around my apartment one day, and I, you know, someone found these pictures. And like, I think in, you know, around 1990, I shaved my head.
Yeah.
Just for something to do. And it was like, you know, I looked like a real badass. And Omar was like, that's not Scott. That's Kill Dog E. So, you know, he started making up all this backstory about Kill Dog E and how, like, you know, he was kind of like Hercules, but like it wasn't like he didn't get his strength from his hair. He got his strength from when he shaved his head, and he like rolled the dice and left them at the crime scene with 4, 5, 6. So we just started all this stuff, and it was just sort of a joke for like sitting around drinking and talking about it. And then I thought, well, when Skiz asked me to do the record, I'm like, okay, that could kind of be sort of the template for sort of a concept record. And originally the idea was like I would make a track and then I'd give it to Omar, and then he would make a painting based on that track, and then he would give me a painting, and then I would make a track based on that painting. And it didn't really work out exactly like that in terms of back and forth, just because, of course, you know, it's like Skiz is like, can you get the record done by March 1st or whatever? I'm like, oh yeah, of course. And like, it was like in the middle of August, I'm in the studio writing the track. So, you know, I was always sort of a bit behind, but there was definitely a collaborative thing between Omar and I in terms of the artwork and the storyline and the music.
And you had a couple of guys from Antipop Consortium on that, yeah, on that record.
You adore the 204. Our literature is splendid till it's ended.
La-di-da, falling off La-gadi-da. I splash through your Mardi Gras, come off like LaGuardia, while MC's trick-popping.
Yep. I met Beans first, like when we were doing
He's on the Vernon record you did. Yeah.
Yeah, it was so funny. He does his rhyme and we're sitting there. And Vernon's sitting there and he goes, did he just say the ghetto Geppetto?
Boy, girl, do a dance, that's divine. Cause when I intertwine a rhyme design, they make you move fingers into bump and jeans to punk the party, people back like peanuts. The ghetto Geppetto can rock shot, rock shot.
Like in that super Vernon kind of, kind of way. Paul's imitation of Vernon is always just like this. Well, actually. Yeah, so I met Beans then and, you know, knew him and would see him around the scene. And I think my assistant at Green Street, Gingy Brown, was friends with Priest. And I met him briefly, but, you know, never had an extensive conversation with him. And then I can't remember how it happened, but I had met Saeed around the same time as I was working on that record, and he was getting interested in studio production and stuff. So he would just come and hang out at the studio, like whatever studio I was at, he would just drive over. He lived up in Westchester, so he had a car, you know, so he was always driving everywhere. And I'm like, oh, I'm in Brooklyn. No, I'm at Green Street. No, I'm at this other place. And, you know, he would just come and hang out, and he'd be like, oh, this is fat. And I'm like, well, do you want to do a verse? And so, you know, okay, yeah. So he rhymed on several tracks, and Priest was on one. I think Saeed's on two or three, and Priest is on one.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, thinking about your whole career as an engineer, as a producer, you've seen technology entirely flip from the, you know, quarter-inch reels, two-inch reels you were talking about, to most setups being, you know, software and in the box and kind of digital-based. What was that shift like for you? Were you, and when digital started coming out, were you sort of resistant to it at first, or did you embrace it?
I was using Pro Tools, and it was called Sound Tools before it was Pro Tools. I was using that stuff kind of as it was being developed. You know, people around me were using it, and studios that I was working at, the place that I did a lot of tracking. My sort of go-to cheap tracking place was this place in the West Village, which was right by the West Side Highway off Christopher Street. So getting Wu-Tang Clan to go down there was always pretty funny. They're like, what the fuck is going on here? And they were doing a lot of student films. And they were, I don't know if they were a beta tester for Pro Tools, but they certainly had a whole Pro Tools set up before Green Street or any of the other sort of conventional analog studios I was working at. So, you know, and I was, you know, we were using Digital Performer and Cubase and all that shit at the same time. So kind of making beats and having people come in with computers and stuff like that. It was sort of a gradual kind of transition to that. I mean, Green Street Recording, which is where I did a lot of mixing, probably a lot of the records that you're asking about were mixed there. And they never actually had a Pro Tools set up. And then they were just about to probably transition into that. And then 9/11 happened, and then the guy who owned the studio just said, fuck it, I don't want to bother reinventing the wheel. Let's just call it a day. And at that point, I had my own Pro Tools rig, a small one that I was in a flight case that I would bring to sessions, and that's what kind of people did for 4 or 5 years, and then every studio had that. And, you know, you'd go to places and want to use the 2-inch machine, and they're like, oh, it's actually not working. I hadn't turned that on for 6 months. I thought it was working. So, you know, it's become pretty rarefied to be, you know, working with tape. I mean, right. I have 2 2-inch tape machines at my studio. We have a 24-track and a 16-track. And I think my partner put the 24-track in storage. But, you know, I'd used it a few times this year to great effect, and it was really cool to do it again. But it doesn't happen. And like I said, it gradually from the early Calliope days to even before the sort of Pro Tools laptop revolution, production was changing in the sense that people would, like, bring in a fully fully right. constructed track.
Right, producer came to almost universally
Primo
something
show
like
up
composer.
With his MPC and a 950 or whatever, and people would started to bring. I mean, Paul was the first guy who ever brought a disc in, and it was just like ting, ting, ting. It was just 4 ride cymbal hits, and that was the beginning of the beat. But he's like, man, I just figured that this, you know. We wouldn't waste so much time. This is what I want the tempo to be or whatever. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, I can figure it out from that for sure. But, you know, that was a number of years that, you know, before people started having their own gear. And I remember, you know, during that sort of crossover time and Paul had his stuff and was making tracks and whatnot, I remember asking Mr. Long, I'm like, so, man, when are you going to get, like, a set up in a sample? And goes, oh, never, man. I like coming here and making you do all that. I'm like, all right, okay. So, and then, yeah, I mean, studios really took a hard hit from all that, you know, there used to be so many recording studios, and that was the only time you could do tracks and record is unless you want to use a Porta studio or something like 4-track cassette or whatever, you'd have to go into a big studio. So it really changed. And, you know, I know guys who were sort of engineer producer guys who would bitch about, oh, I can't believe this, and, you know, these guys are bringing these garbage songs in and they're recording in their bedroom and asking me to mix them, and I'm like, I don't know why you're being such an asshole about it. Like, those guys weren't going to be able to lock out the Hit Factory for 2 months to make their record. They wouldn't be making a record, but they're at least they're bringing it to you to mix it. Like, there was a time when everyone was trying to mix their own record, and I think a lot of people finally realized, like,
right, they need a specialist somewhere.
I need to get someone who knows what they're doing to make this sound good. It's funny, I just finished mixing a record from this kid. My friend Roz and I have this school called the Underground Producers Alliance, and one of my students hired me to mix his record. And I sort of jokingly said to him on the last day, I'm like, well, Connor, I'm really glad I taught you so well in the mixing class that you felt like you didn't learn enough to, like, mix the record yourself. Or maybe I taught you even better to realize that you need somebody who knows what they're doing to mix your record.
Yeah. So what is that school? When did it start?
Like, about 2 years ago. Roz has been working on it for a long time and laying the groundwork for it. He had been teaching at DubSpot and at NYU and the New School. And just saw that, you know, DubSpot in particular were just kind of, he just said, you guys are just trying to sell software and hardware to people. You're not really teaching them about music. So, you know, and he approached me and said, hey, would you be into teaching about mixing? And I wanted to do this. So we have the flagship program. It's called the Ghost Program, where, you know, you can sign up and it's sort of it's like a comprehensive, in-depth overview of the music business, from like shopping for records and making beats and learning about instruments and overdubs. So it's a little bit like the first time we did it was about a year and a half ago. And it was like a 3-hour session on overdubs, 3-hour session on recording vocals, and a 3-hour session on mixing is what I taught. And then after that, Roz said, well, you know, would you like to develop a curriculum for an actual mixing course? And I said, yeah, sure. So last fall, he and I created a syllabus and a big, you know, a lesson plan for 8-session mixing course that we call Mixing the Hard Way. And it's kind of just sort of a top to bottom explanation about mixing both in the box and analog, using a lot of analog stuff, which is sort of my process, which I guess, besides just the pun on my name, is the hard way, because, you know, but it's, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the easy way too, because things sound so much better going through, you know, my Neve console than just coming through a laptop, so that, you know, it's, some ways it's easier, some ways it's a lot harder.
Right.
And, you know, you can't just recall mixes in 5 seconds. You know, I have to try to really make a point to people, like, I can't just call your mix up and run it again on my laptop. I mean, that's what, you know, the first thing I tell my students is that, you know, your mix is something that exists, it's live, it's real. It's not just a folder on your fucking desktop. It's like, today we're mixing this song, and we're going to make decisions about how this song is for all of eternity. Like, you know, like, make decisions.
Yeah.
Think about things. Put yourself on the line. You know, decide. Make decisions. Make bold decisions. Make mistakes. Which, you know, it's harder and harder to make mistakes in this era of auto-tune and beat mapping and all that kind of other crap.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to ask just a quick thing about some of the jazz that you have worked on. You did a bunch of stuff with Medeski, Martin, and Wood, and it seemed like you had a real creative role with them over the course of a couple records, especially on the mixing end of things. Like,
definitely.
On one record, you even essentially kind of created a dub almost, right? To, like, moving elements in and out of the mix and different things like that.
All the records were like that. I mean, the Combustigation less so, but that was the beginning of sort of them being more into a process type of post-recording mixing and production. Kind of on that level. And the Dropper was all sort of heavy, automated mixing. And then the last record, full record I did with just them, which was called Uninvisible, was in Pro Tools and definitely very composed post-recording. So, yeah, I mean, I was kind of the fifth Beatle, like the George Martin on a lot of those records. It was funny when we did The Dropper, which is the second record I did with them. They had purchased a bunch of stuff and built a studio in their rehearsal space in Dumbo. And I was like, look, you guys, we can do anything. And they had hired me exclusively to produce the record. And I said, well, you know, we've got a studio. We can just really be experimental. We can do anything. Like, let's make a Sergeant Pepper's up in here. And they're like, yeah, Scotty, okay, yeah. And then we're at mastering, and we finished mastering. We're at Master Disc, and Howie Weinberg's is finished. And I think he's like, oh, yeah, you guys, you got to check this out. You got to see this. It's amazing. And he goes, my friend from Capitol Records just sent me this. It's a straight-across quarter-inch dub of Sgt. Pepper's. And he had the, like, reel, like an analog reel of Sgt. Pepper's. And I was just like, I just look over at Medeski, and he's like, I remember, man. I said, yeah. This is a trip, right? So, you know, the first day I invoke Sgt. Pepper's and, you know, there we are at the last day at mastering, and Howie Weinberg pulls out a fucking analog master of Sgt. Pepper's. It was pretty incredible to listen to it in that room.
Yeah. And I did want to bring up, back in 08, obviously you had a car accident, mm-hmm. had some spinal damage. And you ended up in a wheelchair. What do you remember about the accident?
I was leaving my studio at around 3 a.m, and I was actually trying to find my seatbelt. And so I was looking down, and next thing I know, we got hit, and the car spun around a few times, and I bashed my head and kind of came to, and I was sort of kneeling on the floor of the back seat of the car, and I couldn't feel my legs, and you know, the car was kind of smoking, and, you know, it was just, we had obviously been in an accident, so kind of what happened, and the two guys who were driving left the scene of the crime, but they left their car there, so, but it's still, It's still kind of a still in process legally, so I can't really talk to about it too much. But essentially, I'm paralyzed from more or less from my shoulders down. So, I mean, the first thing I did when I was in the car was I was like, okay, my hands still work. Right.
And how has that changed how you work, even the sort of...
Oh, it's changed everything in my life. It's a profound thing happens to you. Well, I wouldn't say that I can't do a session by myself anymore, which I used to do all the time and did everything myself. Now, from time to time, if I have to do a setup, I have to bring someone in to help me just set the mics up and stuff. And, you know, for the long time, I had a lot of complications from my accident. So there was times when I was going to the studio and I was working like for 3 hours. I mixed Emily Wells's record, I think 3 hours at a time, which, you know, 10 years ago, I would have been like, 3 hours? I barely turned the machines on in 3 hours and tuned the guitars up. But, you know, you can get a lot done. And actually, sort of a lot of some of my techniques that I teach in my class kind of came out of just learning how to just do things way faster, just because I only had so much time, you know? And the whole digital thing ends up making things faster, too. I mean, you think about it, if you don't have to rewind the tape machine, you know, by the end of the week, you know, you would have spent almost like a full day just rewinding tape for 6 days, you know? So maybe not quite a whole day, but a lot of hours, which is different. I mean, you get a little breathing room in between, like, rewinding the reels and stuff. You don't get that anymore, but it definitely makes things faster. There's no question about it. But so, yeah, that affected me in that way. I mean, it's harder for me to play the guitar and different instruments because my balance, my center of gravity is way up here. But I can, you know, I still play and I still have a few guitars and still can play instrument. I can't play drums anymore.
Right.
It's a drag. But, you know, and I was telling people like, well, I still have my wah-wah pedal, so I have faith that I'll be able to use it again one day, which at this point, after 8 years, it's unlikely I'll ever be able to use my wah-wah pedal with my foot anyway. I'll have to do it Tio Mazzaro style with my hand.
Right, right. And I guess just finally, what are you up to now?
Well, I have a record coming out in a couple of months. Some friends of mine in Brazil wanted to do, I had been doing a bunch of remixes from stuff, and he was aware of a bunch of mixes that I'd done that never came out for one reason or the other. And so he's like, oh, I'd really like to put a vinyl, like a limited edition vinyl out of all your stuff, like stuff of your production, your sort of remix production, beat making, whatever you want to call it. So I sent him a bunch of stuff and he curated a 10 song record. And then I kind of spent several weeks just chopping the shit out of it so that I could get it below 40 minutes. Because I made that mistake too many times. Like, oh, man. Did you get that Ekandayo record?
I did, yes.
I was like, that was like my one regret for that record. I'm like, we should have left one song off that record for the vinyl.
Hmm.
But so I was really hardcore, and I think my record's 19 minutes is one side, and the other side's 18. So, and it has stuff going from 1993 up till the present. There's a track I did for Word Sound, which is one of my own instrumental beats. And then it goes into a song I did with Mr. Dead in the late 90s.
Yo, a lot of cats right now in hip hop, they ain't trying to create nothing, they ain't trying to come original. But what we doing, me and Mr. Scotty Hall, we creating and defining. You know what I'm saying?
And then I think the next song is, and then there's a remix I did for MMW that was on their Radio Alarians remix record. And then there's a song that a remix of a thing I did of a Brazilian folk artist. And then there's a New Kingdom remix I did in 1993 for off the first New Kingdom record. And then there's an APC song that I did that never came out, that was off of Fluorescent Black. Outrun pain, writing rhymes with my burden behind. Now a microphone cyclone, the scotch playing through man's hands. Held the highest team, made you a ghost before Halloween. And blasting with the reeds, the MCs I'm not saying don't follow your dreams, just realize when it's just a... Didn't I send you this?
Yeah.
I did, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and then there's on the first side, there's a song that I did with Ladybug Mecca that was going to be on the Rubble Kings remix record, and that just they couldn't squeeze it on there.
Snipping the wick, light it, fix into the metal, blow it, settle into the corners, wash it, borders, wash it.
So I think they're putting that out, maybe putting it out on an EP, but at this point it's unreleased. So that one, APC. Then there's a song that John Medeski and I did the score for a visual art installation in the like 2001 or something called Suspiria. That was kind of based on this Dario Argento movie. Yeah, so we kind of ripped off this goblin stuff, made our own versions of that. And then there's APC tune. Oh, then there's a remix for Emily Wells that I just did. That would be the 2016 entrance. Her record just came out about 2 months ago, and I did a mix for that. And then the last song on the record is a thing I had originally been on a DJ Olive compilation. And then I kind of repurposed that beat for a movie score that I had done, this movie called Bad Blood with Alan Cumming in it. And I took the cello part from the underscore and put it over top of this beat and used that for the end credits of the record. So that never really came out on, definitely didn't come out on wax. So that's the record. So that's coming out in probably a couple of months. Kid Acne is going to do the cover art. And I've been working on and off with him for about 10 years doing little things. I did a remix for him for a 7-inch for him called Draw. I can't remember. I think it was called, it was on a 7-inch they put out 6 months ago. I mixed one side and then I did a remix the other side. I think it was called Dry Lips, but that could have been the working title. And I can't remember if that was actually the final name. So I did that and, you know, just finished mixing a couple of records for some different people. And Brookzill, which is a band with Prince Paul and Mecca, Don Newkirk, and my buddy Rodrigo Brandão from the Akandayo Project.
Right.
That record's coming out on Tommy Boy.
Oh yeah, he talked about that when we had him here. This is his sort of Brazilian influence.
Oh, you had Paul
project
here?
Yeah.
Oh cool.
Yeah. So how close is that to being finished?
I mixed the whole record twice. I mixed it about a year and a half ago, and then I mixed it again. I was like, what the fuck? Everyone was there. And they're like, well, and then I thought about it. I was like, oh, you know what? I kind of mixed the Gravedigger record twice too. Like Paul's like, I think we could just do this bit better. And then I just did, and we had finished it for over a year, I think. And then I sent the stuff away for mastering. And then they called me and said, we have one more song because Mecca has like a solo kind of song. I'm like, okay, we do that. So I think I mixed, that was about a month ago, 6 weeks ago that Paul and I mixed that. And I think it's coming out in September on Tommy Boy.
Brookzill's debut album, Throwback to the Future, will be out October 7th, 2016.
Yeah, you know, I'll probably teach my class again from time to time and a couple times more this year and more scoring a film for a guy that I worked with on one of the Stan Douglas projects. And I can never keep track of anything. But more stuff on the horizon, more production, you know, making another record.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming through.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for listening.
One of the traps that hip-hop journalism can fall into, as Say Adams pointed out during our interview with him, is believing that artists are the only people worth talking to. While great art is being made, lots of people are in the room and deeply involved in the process. That's why talking to Scotty Hart is so important, and why I'm so glad to bring you this episode. He was a key part of a ton of great records in hip-hop and beyond, and it's incredibly rare to hear about what making albums is like from the perspective of someone who's actually in the studio every day, trying to hold the whole thing together, as when he was pulling double duty with the Gravediggers and Wu-Tang. Join us next week when our guest will be Jermaine Dupri. JD is best known as the founder of So So Def Records and the producer of hits from Mariah Carey, Usher, Destiny's Child, and more. But his hip-hop history goes back all the way to his start as a pre-teen dancing on the Fresh Fest tours of the mid-1980s. We'll take an in-depth look at his whole career, being a child rapper himself in the duo Chad and Jermaine, discovering the child rap stars Criss Cross, developing the sound of Atlanta with his label So So Def, and even his current move into reality TV with his show The Rap Game. You won't want to miss it. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow, where you can help us out for as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
You should be practicing the bass, man. What the fuck?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And I'm like, fuck, I've never done this before.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I only listened to it once.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He'll probably be cheap.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jonathan Waitman.
Fuck you, Jean.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Where the fuck is Carlos?
Not quite that funny.
No, well, I don't think he's going to say anything that funny.
No, probably not.